Kyle Miner is a columnist at Salon, The Nation, and HTML Giant. His work has appeared in Esquire, Best American Mystery Stories, Best American Non-Required Reading, 20-something Essays by 20-something Writers, and 40 Stories, The New Voices from Harper Perennial. He is the recipient of the 2012 Iowa Review Prize, the Tara Kroger Prize for Short Fiction, and in 2006 was named a Best New Voice by Random House. His latest book is a collection of stories called Praying Drunk. Kyle, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
And I got a copy of Praying Drunk, Stories and Questions, and I've been reading it. And I tell you, man, I love this book. The language is amazing. And the book can just absolutely go anywhere, yet it's rooted in a character's need and desire. And it's just a fantastic book. And it just won the third annual Story Prize Spotlight Award. It's given for a short story collection worthy of additional attention. So congratulations on that award.
Thank you. I'm pretty happy about it.
And has it given the book additional attention?
It has, actually, although not so much from readers, but from people who are interested in maybe publishing the next book, and from publishers in other countries and things like that, which surprised me.
Oh,
I was really excited about all of that.
Yeah, well, you do take a lot of risks in this book. In fact, even the subtitle, Stories, Questions, I love that, because not only do the stories raise questions themselves, but you even have sections, Q&A sections, which I think are fantastic. I noticed that subtitle doesn't exist on the front cover. It says Praying Drunk Stories, but when you go inside, it says Praying Drunk Stories, Questions. Is the full title Stories, Questions, or is it just Stories?
Well, in the manuscript version, I put Stories and Questions. I mean, for the reasons that you said, the stories in many ways are extended attempts to reckon with questions, and then there are stories that proceed as questions and answers. Also because a few of the stories in the book were originally published as essays, and the book sort of did away with the genre distinctions among all of those forms. I just decided the path to the things I was interested in didn't exist exclusively with fiction or with nonfiction or with poetry or with anything, and wanted to have the freedom to move around without declaring what it was.
And was it the publisher's decision not to include questions on the cover?
I guess so. You know, I don't really understand a lot about how all that works, but there were 8 or 9 different versions of the cover at one point, and one just rose. So I don't know how intentional that choice was or wasn't.
My last book is called Hotel Juarez, Stories, Rooms, and Loops. And I wanted rooms and loops to be included after stories because I didn't think they were, quite frankly, all stories. Some of them were rooms and loops, and I won't get into what I meant by that. But I was very fortunate that the publisher that I ended up going with just went with it. They go, okay. And what I love about Praying Drunk is, and you mentioned this kind of before, is that it makes little distinction between fiction and memory, i.e. nonfiction. And I'm reminded of a quote by Antonin Artaud where he says, "We have the right to lie, but not about the truth of the matter." I'm wondering, how challenging was it for you to negotiate between this idea of fact or this idea of fiction and this idea of memoir?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that I think you accidentally said memory instead of nonfiction.
Oh, it wasn't an accident.
It's like a really beautiful way to think about it, actually, because if you think about what memory is,
right,
it's kind of an attempt to put together what all that was. And in some ways, it's closer to the spirit of what a fiction writer does than it is to some of the connotations that the word nonfiction has, which tend to be bound up in journalistic ideas,
right,
of objectivity, which is a thing that I'm not even sure exists in the world. There's not like a pristine objective thing somewhere that we can just reach out and grab. We're all trying to make sense of everything with all the resources that we bring to bear, our personal history and our prejudices and our attempts to be noble and our peccadillos and all these things that aren't reconcilable, you know, and we have gaps in our information and things that we misunderstand. And So what I noticed over time is that I seemed to be writing through a series of obsessions, and often I would find I was writing the same things over and over again and coming out in different places. When I tried to remember, I'd remember things in different ways, and I had no way to reclaim, you know, the central memory, if there was one. And I was thinking a lot about these traveling preachers that used to come to the Southern Baptist Church I went to when I was a little kid. It was a hellfire and brimstone kind of place. And they talked about heaven. They said that when you got there, you would just spend all your time like singing the same songs that you sing in church,
right.
You know, gathered around the throne. And that sounded terrible to me, really boring.
Right.
And I figured once if I made it in there, probably I would just end up doing the same thing I do now, which is like sitting in a chair trying to figure out what to do with the troubling things about the past and going over and over and over it. And I realized that's what the book is. It's a reckoning of that sort, and maybe that's who the narrator is too.
You know, if I die right now and I go to a place where everybody's just singing and wearing white, I'd be thinking, I want a beer. Where can I find a beer?
Where are all the interesting people?
And I'd probably end up in a smelly bar that's, you know, a bar that smells like still cigarettes and beer and spend the rest of my life in hell. This idea of memory, I mean, it's very clear that you're accessing memory, but what I love about your approach is that you're not doing it in a very linear way. You're not trying to recall facts. And there's this one story with a repeated line, and the repeated line is, I'm 12 years old, standing beneath a star fruit tree. And I love that line. It keeps anchoring back to that line, and then it goes in other places. It goes to amazing images. It goes to that idea of fire and brimstone. You just touch on everything, but that keeps pulling it back and pulling it back. Was that a conscious use of repetition as if you were writing a poem, or is it just something that just kind of came out as you were accessing memories?
I had this friend in graduate school. Her name was Ayanna Wilson. She was from Trinidad. And she wrote this essay one time called Sour Mangoes. It was about a sour mango tree. She never cared much for it, you know. She just turned it into class and it went away. This is when I was at Ohio State in graduate school. And I just kept thinking about that thing. And then one day I was having lunch with her and I was like, where'd you get the idea to build that essay around that tree? And she said that she had been talking to this guy, and he said, you know, if you're having trouble getting to an emotion, you should just find like a plant in the front yard, write about that. And like whatever you're really preoccupied will immediately start to attach to that. And I was having similar trouble because I was trying to write about this childhood bully, but I was doing it by trying to annotate the book of Ecclesiastes, you know, like in footnotes, like I was under the spell of David Foster Wallace. And I was like, well, maybe I should just right about the tree. And, you know, as it happened, there was this important tree. There's a starfruit tree. I went to school on this campus that was reclaimed from a used car salesman's estate. And then when the city grew around it, he sold it and it became a school. And he had imported all these exotic plants from all over the world. And there's a starfruit tree, you know, and I go there every morning and I pick a fruit from it. I found out later, this isn't in Praying Drunk, but I found out later that the starfruit actually has a neurotoxin in it. Like if you ate enough of it, you could kill all your brain cells. You know? Weirdly, it may actually have the property of dulling pain in a way. And I thought it was so interesting that at the most painful time in my life, I was every morning eating this fruit that may have had the property that it dulled pain. So, I mean, that's kind of how it happened. Of course, I was studying poetry at the time, and I was very much taken with the idea that emotion rises from the relationship between a pattern and the variation that you throw into the pattern. And I was very dissatisfied with the short fiction that I was mostly reading, which mostly was coming down from the minimalists from the 80s, Raymond Carver, people like that. I was a lot more excited with what I was seeing in poetry, but there's a kind of a restlessness with regard to form and telling stories in different ways. And so I don't think I could point to one thing as the origin for that, but I think all of that was in the process at the time.
I'm talking to Kyle Miner, author of Praying Drunk, which is a collection of stories, just came out with Saraband Books. You're talking about that starfruit. I'm looking at starfruit right now on Google image search. But you're also talking about how, you know, the chemical effects the starfruit has on your brain, and how that was just kind of a very serendipitous metaphorical possibility in standing under the starfruit tree. I mean, it's not a forced metaphor. You didn't do it on purpose. You weren't doing math, but it just shows one of the incredible things about our brains when we learn our craft and when we learn how to trust the language and to trust ourselves, and we follow that language into a story, that it makes all these incredible connections. And that's what I think this story and this entire book, it allows for following language. It allows for the poetry. It allows for the lyricism, but it just connects in so many wonderfully amazing ways that it's almost like we're looking at your brain here, Kyle.
That's a scary thing to me.
Well, it's an often dark place. You know, you mentioned David Foster Wallace. You're kind of, you know, if not, I won't go as far as to say you're influenced by him, because I think that we could access writers that we've never even read and that have come long before us and read them and go, oh my God. It's like I stole from them, you know, or if time weren't linear, they stole from us. But I do see very similarities between you and David Foster Wallace, and also a little bit of Italo Calvino. And I'm particularly talking about that first story, The Question of Where to Begin. It parallels All at One Point story by Italo Calvino. I don't know if you've ever read it.
And, you know, I've never read that story.
You know,
I have to go find it right away.
Oh, you have to read it, because there are so many similarities. And I think that a lot of times, you know, when we read stories that are similar, we say, oh, well, so-and-so must have been influenced by so-and-so. But I think there's more of a, if you access language and you access time, space, and you go in reverse, like this story does, it starts with an uncle blowing his brains out, and then it just goes back and further into history, all the way into the Big Bang. It even evokes the Big Bang. It's very similar to Italo Calvino. And even though your language is much, much different, I think I would describe this book as a companion to the way Italo Calvino sees the world, although it's much, much more personal. Have you read Calvino at all? Or?
Yeah, I have. I have read a few books, but I probably not nearly enough. Although, I mean, when you describe the things in that way, it makes me feel like you're talking about a person that's a lot smarter than I actually am. I mean, a lot of those kinds of choices I came to, you know, organically, because I was trying to think about something that was bothering me. In the right. case of that story, I was thinking about the day that I went to the funeral of my uncle, who had just committed suicide, and he'd had a hard life because he'd been hit by a city dump truck and he had been brain damaged and his family fell apart. And the thing I remember the most about that funeral, and many other funerals I've been to too, is that the thing that the air seemed thickest with was the question of, who do we blame for this?
Right.
Because clearly it's a tragedy. And when you start to ask those questions of blame, they get real complicated real fast, because there seems to be a cause and effect chain that you can just keep backtracking all the way through history, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, what if the moment it got ridiculous and that I realized that this is what the story was when I started tracing that backward and I asked the question, what if the wind had blown a different way and the Spanish had won the Battle of the Spanish Armada, you know,
right.
1588. But I mean, all of those things actually do form the baseline for our lives. I mean, that one question probably you're calling from El Paso, right?
Yes, sir.
I mean, the history of El Paso has everything to do with the way that the winds blew at 1588.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
And the political interaction among people who speak English and people who speak Spanish, and both, has everything to do with that moment, which seems so impossibly remote to me. So, yeah, I mean, it was just the question that opened that up.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly elegant story, because even if you're not giving your intellect the credit for it, your brain certainly knows a lot more than your consciousness. And the brain has ways of putting things together when we trust our language, when we trust, you know, we go into something, we go into a question, we go into a rhythm. And one of the things that you said, I think, is absolutely brilliantly stated. You say the variables within a story can alter a story significantly. And so you're talking about all these variables. What if, yeah, the wind had been this way? What if this? What if that? And I think I like the word variables better than the word details when it comes to fiction. In fact, after reading this book, I think I'm going to say, I'm not going to say God is in the details. I'm not going to say the devil is in the details. I'm going to say that God is in the variables. it's that intersection, you know, between, you know, what if and what is and what if and what is.
And yeah, and then also, like, who gets to speak about it? And, like, from what point in their lives do they speak about it, you know? And with what, like, external pressures are they speaking? And with what idea of to whom they're speaking?
Right.
Well, I mean, when you start to think about what a story is, you start to realize, like, there's a near infinite amount of possibilities. If a story used everything that attached to it, eventually it would have attached to it everything that had ever happened in the history of the universe,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, like, you have to find a way to wrangle that. And I started to think, well, the only way I know to wrangle it is to find the most limited fixed position somewhere and just start from there in the most prejudiced way possible. By prejudiced, I mean prejudiced by those limitations at that moment, and then applying the full force of not only the intellect, but also all the emotional upheaval and the grievance and everything to be the arbiter of all those choices.
I'm thinking of Shakespeare. I shall be bound in a nutshell and count myself king of infinite space. And the idea that when you look at the tiny variables and the way the tiny, most minute variables may affect our narratives vis-a-vis the huge, you know, in variables, earthquakes, wars, and all that stuff, that life, you know, reality is really in between these two things. And your book encompasses desire. It encompasses, you know, fear, insecurity, that poor kid, which I suppose is you because you name him Minor, being picked on by McKinnick. Yet there's these questions of heaven and hell. And there's even, I noticed there's even some idea of physics. In fact, I think a lot of times the physics metaphors are pretty powerful. Do you read physics for fun?
No, I don't understand physics at all.
Yes, you do. You understand a lot more than you think you do. Let me ask you a question about we have the beginning story and then we have the ending story. In the beginning, the uncle has blown off his head, and in the ending story, the nephew has blown off his head. And I'm wondering how this frame came about. Did it just happen, or was it crafted, or was it something you realized later? Oh my God, these things are encompassing, you know, the entire book. How did that go about? How did that happen?
No, I just went through like a 5 or 10 year period of my life in which everybody was blowing off their heads.
Jeez.
You know, but all these people I knew, all these people in my family, suicide after suicide, and then the rupture that would inevitably follow when people tried to figure out what to do with their pain. And so, you know, it was just organic. It wasn't a plan. Everything about the book that looks like a design was the last choice of the book, you know?
All right.
I mean, I always thought of the book as a document of a lot of failures to address these preoccupations, which were so difficult and so dark. And then one day I just realized, like, well, I mean, this is what it is, man. And this is like, this form is true to what the material is concerned with, because ultimately there aren't the kind of answers that would comfort so much when it comes to problems that are that, well, there's so much beyond our ability to solve, and you try to reckon with them, but the reckoning is always incomplete and always seems like a failure. And that's what it is.
Wow.
You know? And so that's why the book has such a weird form.
There's a section called Q&A, and I call it a section because I'm not quite sure you could call it a a story, but one of the questions is, what is the purpose of this book? And the answer is, a catalog of stories and sadness, beginnings and endings, the stuff of childhood, death. Nothing new can happen here, so all you do is think of the days of life when possibility hadn't been ripped from you forever, when anything can happen, and wondered why so much was squandered, so much wasted. Does that describe the book?
Yeah, and I remember writing that because that's one of the last things I wrote in the book. Yeah, I was thinking also, I had just read a story by John Updike that he wrote almost before he died called The Walk with Elizon. And it's a story in which it begins at the end with these old people going to a high school reunion, but it ends with this moment where this man and woman, I mean, not even a man and a woman, they're like two high school seniors are going on a walk. And as they walk, it seems as though anything could happen, right? And they don't know the end of the story, but the reader knows the end of the story. And the end of the story is nothing happened between them. But at that one moment, anything could have happened, right? Mm-hmm. Their whole life was ahead of them. And it could have been exciting. They could have been together, they could have found love, but nothing. Oh. And I was thinking about that.
It's a powerful book, and everything seems incredibly organic, no matter where the book goes. Nothing is forced in this, but it goes everywhere. So congratulations on Praying Drunk, and thank you for joining us, Kyle, on Words on a Wire.
Thank you.